This you have seen on the two visits within our ships, out beyond the limits of your own atmosphere. These vary in size, from infinitely small dust particles, invisible to the human eye, to the largest planets and suns without number. All are bathed in the sea of one power, supported by the one life. On your world you have named the many forms which you have seen, man, animal, plant, and so on. Names are but man's perceptions, while in the infinite sea of space names as you use them are meaningless. The infinite intelligence cannot name itself, for it is all complete. And all forms have been, and always shall be, dwelling within the complete. Among the many forms, the one which you call man professes to possess the only true intelligence upon your earth. Yet this is not so. There is no manifestation upon your world or anywhere within the limitless universe that does not express intelligence in some degree. For the divine creator of all forms is the expresser through creation. It is his manifestation, a thought expression of his intelligence. As a man, you are no more and no less than this. For the very life by which every form is supported, and the intelligence that expresses itself through it, is a divine expression. Earth man, for the most part, not knowing this, finds much fault with many things outside his personal self, not realizing that each form expresses its purpose and renders the service for which it was made. There is no form that is capable of judging another, since all forms are but servants unto the One Supreme. None knows all that is to be known, since none knows all that is. This is known only to the All-Knower. But all forms, by serving willingly, grow in understanding of the source from which they receive their wisdom, the same life force by which they exist. In the full conception, all manifestations of all forms are like beautiful flowers in a vast garden where many colors and many kinds bloom harmoniously together. Each blossom feels itself through the manifestation of another. The low looks up to the tall. The tall looks down to the low. The various colors are a delight to all. The manner of growth fills their interest and intensifies a desire for fulfillment. In observing the beauty unfold that lies dormant within, whether in a day or a century, design gradually becomes manifest, in color, in a fragrance sweet to all others. Each glorifies itself by service rendered unto others, and in turn, receives from all others. All in the great field of beauty are the givers and the receivers, vessels through which flows a melody from the highest. Thus some serve at the foot of the throne, while others serve above the throne and all around it. Each blends with every other, expressing only joy because privileged to serve. It is likewise that the human expression which you know as man should have learned to live in the beginning of his dwelling upon your world. But in this lesson he failed. Had he not, your earth would have been a garden of joy, the garden of an everlasting desire to serve. But man, in his lack of understanding, has destroyed the harmony of his being on your earth. He dwells in enmity with his neighbor, his mind divided in confusion. Peace he has never known, true beauty he has not seen. No matter how he prides himself on his material achievements, he lives still as a lost soul. And who is this man that dwells in such darkness? He is the mortal one who has failed to serve the immortal one. It is he who speaks of the path, but seeks not the way to go. It is he who fears all things beyond the understanding of his fettered mind. Little is he who has denied the hunger of his spirit. And the fear which man has literally become stands firm in its guard against all life, against all things. For if this fear should move out of its own shadow, it would cease to be. This it is which holds man a prisoner until the end of his mortal side. Indeed, man dwells on earth today desolate under the fear and dread of what he calls death, the end of his mortal life, alone in the wilderness of his personal darkness. Yet man himself has brought about the desolation which he so bitterly deplores, all because of service not rendered as it is naturally rendered by the humbler forms that surround him. Instead, man continues to destroy their life manifestations that he may survive. He has failed to realize the richness that these others could bestow upon him, would he allow them to serve as they were meant to serve. Alas, man's plot upon earth is barren indeed. The seeds he sows with his small understanding yield bitter fruit. Still he remains fettered to his ignorance, repeating his errors through the centuries, still hoping to find that for which his heart longs, and for which his soul cries out. He is fearful of turning away lest that upon which he stands, the earthly foundation he has built for himself, may be taken from him by another, and he will have nothing. So he keeps guard over that which is not eternal but, by the moment, is in process of change and decay, his eyes blind to what is happening. He has imprisoned within himself the light that could have guided him over the road of eternal oneness, a joy that all others who have gone that way have actually become. These are the servants, sons and daughters of the one Father, in all worlds. The Father, creator of that beautiful field of the many forms, the many colors, the many shades, the many heights and the many depths, the many delights that play and express, by day and by night, the one song of celestial harmony in which all may join. As he spoke, pictures of his words passed vividly before me and again my understanding of man's plight upon earth was quickened. As he ceased speaking, no one stirred. Nor did I wish to break the silence. As the pictures ceased flowing through my mind, the Master rose from his seat opposite and walked around the table toward me. All rose then and remained quietly standing. The great teacher touched my hand lightly, and my whole being sang in humble gratitude for that which he had given to me. I gladly would have stayed in his presence forever, but I knew from previous experience that this was not to be. My son, do not be discouraged if you meet with ridicule and disbelief on your earth. With the understanding we have given, you will know why it cannot be otherwise. Tell your brothers and sisters what you have learned. There are many with open hearts and minds, and these will grow in numbers. The scout is waiting and our brothers will accompany you back to earth. Now that we have been together in this way, you can the more easily at all times make contact from your mind to ours. Remember always that space is no barrier. His words filled me with a contentment that allowed of no emptiness. Bidding me farewell, he turned and left the room. In a moment, Firkin and Zell motioned to me. I said goodbye to my new friends, and when the lounge door slid silently open for us, we made our way across the elevator platform and into the waiting craft. Slowly we descended, silently gliding down the rails. Away from this gigantic laboratory carrier. As we glided earthward, I glanced back at the large ship waiting there in space for the return of this little one. I wondered just how large it really was. Although my thought remained unspoken, Azul replied, "You might estimate it to be, in your figures, about 300 feet in diameter and something like 3,500 feet in length. These are not exact figures, but close enough." It seemed but a matter of seconds before the door of the scout opened and we were back on Earth. Farewells were said within the scout, for the pilot did not come out with us. The Martian and I walked to where we had left the car several hours earlier and set off on the journey to the hotel. I glanced back toward the scout and saw it fast disappearing from sight, far up in our atmosphere. As on the previous occasion, we were silent during the drive back to the hotel. I had much to think about and had no inclination to talk. I recall that the air held an early morning freshness and the first rays of the sun were just breaking through. So absorbed was I in remembering the Master's words that I paid no attention to the scenery through which we passed. When the car drew up in front of the hotel, Firkin touched my hand in the usual manner as he said, "We shall meet again." I knew that we wouldn't, although back on Earth in body, in consciousness I was both on Earth and with my friends of other worlds as they journeyed on through space. It was wonderful to know that we were not separated, that we never again could be separated. This night, a realization which had lain dormant within me throughout this present life's journey had suddenly blossomed into an awakening, even as the flowers in the garden which had been described to me by the Wise One. The joy within my heart from this realization was as the melody of infinity, blended without separation or division. And I hoped and prayed that a way might be revealed whereby I could share this realization with others upon the earth. I returned to my room in the hotel, but not to sleep. My experiences of the night had so strengthened and invigorated me that I felt like a new man, my mind awake and alert with thoughts more vivid and swift than ever before. My heart sang with joy, and my body was freshened as though from a long rest. There was much to be done this day, and tomorrow I must return to my home on the mountain, but from now on I would, to the best of my ability, live each moment as it came, complete in its fullness, serving the one intelligence as man is intended to do, and for which purpose he was created. 11. Conversation in a cafe about the 1st of September. I began to get the feeling that soon I would again be seeing our friends from space. Often during the summer I had watched their ships moving through our atmosphere, but apparently the need for personal meetings had not arisen. With each day that passed I felt a greater urgency to return again to the city. On September 8th, a friend who had been spending some time with us at Palomar Gardens invited me to drive to Los Angeles with her. I accepted, and at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon we arrived in the city. I registered at the usual hotel, accompanied the bellboy to my room, freshened up a bit and returned again to the lobby. To my great surprise and pleasure, there, waiting for me, and smiling broadly, were Firkin and Ram. After greetings were exchanged, I asked if they were in a hurry. As if knowing my thoughts, Ram replied, "Not in the least. We are here to answer any questions which you have in mind, to the best of our ability," he added, smiling. I suggested that we go to the little restaurant where we could eat and talk without being disturbed. As we walked along, I said, "I suppose you are quite aware of the chief thing that is bothering me." Firkin smiled and said, "Perhaps you are wondering whether the answers to those mental questions you shot into space this summer really got back to you without the wires crossed?" "Exactly," I exclaimed with a sigh of relief. Due to the early hour, the restaurant was nearly empty. We sat down in a booth at the far end and ordered sandwiches and coffee. I explained to the waitress that we had dropped in more for the purpose of discussing a little business in a comfortable spot than to eat. She urged us cordially to make ourselves at home, served us quickly and left to resume her conversation with the cashier. "What about that scoutmaster in Florida?" I asked, "and the reports that some kind of flame had been directed at him from the saucer?" "Never," Firkin replied emphatically. "We don't do things like that. What actually happened was that the man was frightened. Not wanting to reveal this by running away, he began hacking at the ship with his machete, hardly knowing what he was doing. Anyway, he came too close to the power that operates the scout and got burned. To make it a little clearer," he went on, "you know that a rope has no fire in it, yet will cause a burn when pulled too quickly through the hands. In much the same way, the power emanating from the scout passed over this man's body very rapidly, causing the body, acting with resistance, to be burned." "You had a similar experience," Rama reminded me, "on your first meeting with Orthin when your arm was caught by the power pulsating below the scout. You were not actually burned, but you would have been had you lost your balance and fallen under the flange. Orthin saved you by pulling you back." I then asked how much truth there was in the Brush Creek reportings. "Those sightings were actual," Firkin replied, "although the craft and people are not part of our group. There have been many similar sightings and personal meetings with one or more individuals apart from yours, some before and some since your first contact. These have occurred in almost every nation in the world. Your experience, however, was the first reported in a way to reach great numbers of people. Although such contacts have been taking place for years and records of them made which were never released, few men dare relate their experiences because of the incredulity of their fellow men." He added very simply, "We do not enjoy the secrecy with which we have to make such meetings. We would far rather be welcome to come and go, and to visit with your people as we do with those of other worlds. But so long as our visits are not understood and are therefore made dangerous for us and for our ships, we will have to continue with the present caution." I asked for information as to what had really taken place when Captain Mantilla met his death. Ramo explained, the sincerity of his feelings showing clearly. "That was an accident which we regretted deeply. The ship he was pursuing was a large one. Members of the crew had noticed Captain Mantle coming toward them and knew that his interest was sincere, not belligerent. They slowed down their craft and attempted to contact him through his instruments. They were fully aware of the power radiating from their ship and thought it would halt his approach without injury to him. But as he came closer, the wing of his plane cut through this power, allowing a suction to take place which pulled the entire plane into it, causing an immediate disintegration of both the plane and his body. This disintegration, Rama further explained, takes place through a magnetic radiation that separates the molecules which hold material together, completely changing their position. If his plane had been round, or cigar-shaped, the accident would not have happened. His plane was not uniform in shape. The wings protruded beyond the body of the ship, and it was a wing that was the cause of the accident. The fuselage would not have caused sufficient suction to pull the plane in. But once the wing was caught in the power, the remainder of the plane was sucked in so fast that it was reduced to small pieces of debris falling to the earth, with some portions totally converted into dust particles. On the other hand, he continued, we can come alongside our own ships and nothing of this kind would take place because we design our ships in a way which permits them to equalize any impact. The spacecraft's intent was merely to reduce speed and make an attempt to communicate with him. We had not realized that his plane could not touch our power and stand up under it. You will lose many, many men flying this kind of ship, and especially your jet planes, for they are in danger not only from the radius of our power, but they can enter natural magnetic currents that would twist and destroy them. There are too many points sticking out from the bodies of your planes, for once the power hits any one of them, the ship is doomed. This completed my list of questions concerning the outstanding contacts that had been brought to my attention during the summer. You have verified my impressions in each case, I told my companions. Then perhaps we can try to cover in advance some of the many questions that will be asked of you in the future, Firkin suggested. As you have been told before, planets and systems are constantly in the process of being formed, or going through the process of disintegration. A system of planets is much like any other form. A certain period of time is required to reach a peak of expression, then begins the process of decline and disintegration. Long before our system was even in the making, there were systems of planets without number on which were human beings such as you call mankind. Then, as today, there was interplanetary travel within systems and between systems. The main purpose for such travel was the same as ours is now, to study the activities of space in all of its phases. So, when a new planet within a system of planets was found to be in the making, these were observed and studied closely by travelers from many worlds. When a new planet is found to have developed to the point where it is ready for human habitation, and all planets reach that stage, sooner or later, the travelers let this fact be known to the inhabitants of other worlds and of worlds in other systems. Volunteers are sought who desire to go forth and develop the new world. Then large ships take these volunteers, with all essential equipment on board, and move them to the new planet. Frequent additional trips are made to bring equipment and supplies to these pioneers, as needed. People are also carried back to their native planets for visits. In this way, new channels of expression are opened and, simultaneously, a new world inhabited by mankind. The Earth was the slowest planet in our system to reach the stage where it was capable of maintaining human life. The first inhabitants of Earth were brought to it from the other planets. But it was not long before something unexpected took place in the atmosphere surrounding the Earth, and the transplanted people realized that within a few centuries living conditions on this globe would not be favorable. As a result, the first inhabitants of Earth, with a few exceptions, packed all of their belongings into spaceships and left for other worlds. The few who chose to remain had permitted themselves to deteriorate amidst the lush beauty and abundance of this new world and sought nothing different. Gradually, they became content to live in natural caves and were eventually lost in the annals of time. On your Earth, there is no record of these earliest inhabitants other than the mythology of one of your races, in which the memory of this first civilization is preserved in what they call the god Triton, named after the original race of Triteria. Shortly after the departure of the space pioneers, many natural changes took place on the Earth's surface. Some lands were swallowed in the depths of the waters, while others rose. Then, once again, the world was ready for human habitation. But this time, because of the conditions still prevailing in the surrounding atmosphere, volunteers were not sought. another condition that we had watched with interest in observing the formation and development of the Earth planet was the forming of only one moon as its companion. Under the natural law of conditions, this would result in an unbalanced state unless at some future time another moon was formed to complement the small companion of a growing world. At this point Rama was interrupted as the waitress came over to fill our cups with hot coffee. When she had left, Firkin said, "Man is a strange creature. And this is true wherever you find him throughout the vast universe. Although the race of man as a whole prefers to live in peace and harmony with all creation, here and there a few will grow in personal ego and aggressiveness, and through greed will desire to assume power over other men. This can happen even on our worlds, despite the teaching which bids man live in accordance with the divine laws." "Yes," Rama said, "and even though we know the evil toward which such attitudes lead, in conformity with the universal laws, we are not free to bind these brothers in any way. So, centuries ago, in a meeting among the teachers of wisdom on many planets, it was decided to ship such selfish ones to new planets capable of maintaining human life. In such cases, the planet of slowest development in many systems was selected for the exile of such culprits. So, for the reasons that I have just mentioned, the Earth in our system was chosen for the new home of these unruly ones from many planets inside and outside of our system. These exiles were what you on Earth call troublemakers. We could neither destroy nor confine them, since that is contrary to the universal laws. But as these people were all the same arrogant nature, it was felt that, since none would yield to the other, they would eventually be forced to work out their own harmony. These are the true source of your original 12 tribes on Earth. And so they were gathered in ships from the many planets and transported to Earth, without equipment or implements of any kind, such as volunteers are given. All had been well educated on their own worlds to know the soil, the minerals, the atmosphere and the many other things necessary for physical maintenance. Here on this new world they must use their knowledge and start with nothing more than nature herself provided. This was for the purpose of forcing them to work and draw upon their own talents, in the hope of bringing them back into the fold of all who do the will of the Creator. These are your biblical fallen angels, the human ones who fell from a higher state of life and sowed the original seeds for the conditions which you now find existing in your world. For a long time after bringing these people to Earth, our people of many worlds visited them often, helping and guiding them as much as they would permit. But they were a haughty and defiant lot, and did not welcome the help we offered. Nevertheless, after the early clashes, for a long time they managed to live well enough with one another. At that time Earth was indeed a Garden of Eden, since everything was plentiful and nature was lavish with her gifts of food and the necessities of life. In the joy of the new world, these newcomers began to dwell in peace and happiness with one another, and there was rejoicing on other planets. Then, as your Bible relates it, man ate of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and in time divisions entered where before there had been none. Greed and possessiveness again became rampant amongst men and they turned one against the other. As time went on and the population increased, out of the original tribes arose self-exalted men who began to differentiate between the several races. Each demanded their rulership of the whole people, professing to have come from a planet further advanced than all the others, and by that right entitled to their ruling power. We continue to visit these erring brothers, always with the hope of helping them to return to a brotherly relationship. As time went on, however, the self-appointed rulers became more and more powerful, and our efforts of less and less avail. The divisions continued and increased, finally resulting in the establishment of what you today call nations. The establishment of nations further separated brother from brother, and the whole of mankind lived no longer by the divine law. As a result of these divisions, many different ways of worship arose. But even then we continued to send others out in the hope of aiding our brothers on earth. These men were those known as messiahs, and their mission was to help their earthly brothers to return to their original understanding. In each instance, a few followers would gather around these wise ones, but always they were destroyed by those whom they had come to serve. You have wondered why Earth is the lowest planet in our system within a universe of which we are all inhabitants. I have now told you. The people on all worlds which have been developed, my men and women who volunteered for such service, have gone steadily ahead. They have lived as the infinite Creator intended that His children should live. They have grown and expanded in fulfilling the will of the Father. And each time that a group of volunteers leaves their own world to venture forth into a new one, after the divine hand has prepared it for human habitation, they are actually entering a new school of experience whereby they gain still greater understanding of a total universe. Thus they fit themselves for continuous advancement into higher and higher states of expression and service. Labor such as you know on earth has no part in their life, for as soon as the inhabitants of any planet work under the will of their Creator, the elements in turn begin to serve them. On earth you have just the reverse. For, through self-exaltation and the perversion of natural law, man turns the elements against himself. Man warring against man is one of the most obvious examples of this, as he directs destructively the energies intended by his Creator for his welfare. And that is the primary difference between Earth's inhabitants and the peoples of other planets. Earth man has repeatedly attained certain peaks, only to enter into another stage of destruction which, through misuse of the elements, has destroyed all that he has accomplished. Here and there, an individual lifts himself above the majority on your world, since it is left to each man to speed up or slow down his own evolvement. Only when Earth men learn, by their own mistakes, that what they look upon as their strength is really weakness when pitted against the all-divine intelligence, and that their wisdom but confusion against the all-knowledge, will they be ready to return to the fold. Meanwhile, we keep ourselves ever alerted to receive the call for whatever help men of earth may truly desire, for they are still our brothers. Do you never become discouraged? I asked, in the face of such overwhelming odds. It was Firkin who said, "We know nothing of what you call discouragement. That is a negative word. Long ago we learned the power of faith and hope, and of never giving up. The goal lost yesterday can be won tomorrow. This does not mean that we believe ourselves developed to the fullest extent. Far from it. We have eternity yet to travel. But on our worlds, we no longer have sickness or poverty, as you know it, nor crime, as you know it. We recognize man as the highest representation of deity, the consummation of all lesser forms. Should we with hurtful intent harm any form, we know that we would be forcing that form to turn from its natural purpose and do us harm. You can see why the Creator has left us all to work out our own problems. When His laws are disobeyed, they witness against us. You speak of Satan as though he were a separate enemy. But only by opposing the divine principle can one create the inharmonious conditions which you have credited to Satan, and which you yourselves must correct. Then you will find that Satan becomes an angel of light, as your scripture tells you. For all distortion must be corrected by the one who distorts." As Firkin paused, Ramu's mouth curved in the slight, grave smile so characteristic, as he said, "The sun rules not the earth, nor does the earth rule the sun, nor do the stars rule each other. All are ruled by the Father. Here, from nature herself, does man begin to learn." For some reason, this called to mind a subject on which I had long pondered. In regard to what we call death and rebirth, I asked, should we be able to carry memories of the one life over into the next? Ramu answered, that is possible in varying conscious degrees. Eternal man forgets nothing. But the memory of things learned in a former body seldom manifests as more than an instinctive knowledge of, or gravitation toward, certain familiar things. In his conscious mind, Earth man has little understanding of why this is so. When such aptitudes manifest in lesser degree, you label them talents or gifts. When present to a very marked degree, and especially when present in childhood, you call such people prodigies. Your planet is functioning under what you might call a low frequency. As a result, the growth and development of forms of life, and especially that of man, is slow, requiring much time between birth and maturity. When men are born on Earth, they remain in a helpless infantile stage for a far longer period than on other planets. By the time they have reached manhood or womanhood, whatever memory may have come over them with them at birth is well buried under the welter of misconceptions with which, during all those early years, they have been filled. Independent of natural law, man's reasoning powers are very limited. The newcomer is crammed with the traditions and conventions of past centuries, and the positive memory of previous experience is crowded out.